You're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, I have the privilege of speaking to Konstantin Konietzky, the head of energy for the largest environmental NGO in Ukraine, EcoAction. Since the early days of Russia's war in Ukraine, Kostya and his colleagues have been mapping the ongoing environmental damage caused by Russia's invasion and working to encourage a green post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. In our conversation, Kostya shares how the war has shifted EcoAction's priorities and approach, and how his organization is working with partners to address short-term energy needs in Ukraine while also enabling a more secure and sustainable energy future. Kostya, it's really wonderful to have you here with us today. Thanks for taking the time out of your trip to D.C. I want to start by asking you a little bit about your background and about how the last year has been for you personally, but then also getting into the work that EcoAction has done and has been doing. We want to hear a lot about that. So how are you, first of all, and how has the last year played out for you?
Yeah, thanks. Firstly, thanks for inviting me. So this is a very loaded question because I'm fine-ish and I have been telling it for the past year because I cannot really put into words like the whole scope what's happened to me personally and to our organization, to Ukraine. We are trying to advocate already for the reconstruction of Ukraine, for it to be a green one. And I am working at one of the biggest Ukrainian environmental NGOs called EcoAction. We are trying to navigate the space currently between the war actually happening. It's still happening. It didn't end. It's still going on. And actually talking about the future, it can seem strange. At times, it does seem strange. It's very strange for me to be in Washington where there are no air raid sirens, where I hear some noises and I'm not sure. Oh, maybe it's like, it's in Kyiv. But it cannot be the air raid alert. So in that regard, it's pretty stressful, but it's also one of the things that helps me personally, and I'm sure for my colleagues also, to stay sane and to stay in focus, to be able to do something that will help Ukraine. Because I'm a man and I'm not in the army, not yet, I wasn't drafted. So this is also for me personally the question, how can I be useful? So this kind of trips, this kind of advocacy work, this kind of interviews, I think it's also what fuels me with like the idea that I do something useful and that can help Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. That idea of sort of contributing to the efforts in the country. When we were talking a little bit ago, you mentioned that sort of what the first days of the war felt like for you and your experience. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I remember very clearly like the 5 a.m. On 21st of February, I woke up. And at first, like I woke up from sounds, like I didn't know what the sounds were. And at first, you know, you wake up and you are disoriented. And my first thought was, it was like fireworks. And I went to sleep. And then my girlfriend woke up afterwards and she said, no, Kostya, it's bombs. And we started like frantically searching information on the internet, and the internet was working. We understood that, okay, it's happening throughout Ukraine, in Odessa, in Kharkiv, in Kyiv, in Western Ukraine, also in Lviv. And we understood, okay, this is a full-scale Russian invasion. And then we packed our things and we traveled on the 24th in the evening. We traveled to Western Ukraine just in case. Because there were all this news that Russians are advancing on Kyiv, and we decided to leave and be able to work from more safe-ish space because there are no like safe places right now in Ukraine. And it was a very strange time because the first thing I did like work-wise was on the 25th of February, and we started advocating and communicating with our European partners for Ukrainian electricity system to be connected to the European one, because there was a huge process. So Ukrainian electricity system was preparing itself to be disconnected from the Russian one and connected to the European one, and it was planned to do in 2023. So by the plans in 2022, there were supposed to be two pivot periods in winter and in summer where our electricity system disconnected from Russia, and then it should have connected again. And this first disconnection happened like 7 hours before the invasion. So when the Russian army started marching on Kyiv and other cities, our electricity system was functioning like an island mode. We weren't connected neither to the European one, neither to the Russian and Belarus one. So this is the first like official letters we sent on the 25th about like, please, you know the situation, please connect us to ENTSO-E, it's called ENTSO-E, European system. Please connect us as soon as possible, because otherwise this is a huge strain for energy system for and for the whole Ukraine. And actually it happened 3 weeks later. So it did happen. So I think it's also one. I think I like to think that we were also one of the drops that helped, because it, obviously not only we advocated for it, of course, but we were also one of the people who were doing it. So yeah, and then I worked for a couple of months from Western Ukraine, and then in June I returned again to Kyiv and have been there like ever since.
Can you tell us a little bit? Tell us about EcoAction. It's the Ukraine's largest environmental NGO. You head the energy department, but you have colleagues working across other different areas. Tell us about EcoAction and how the work that you're doing has changed over the last year.
EcoAction was founded in 2017. So actually, I think on Saturday it will be exactly 6 years. So this is like
happy birthday
of EcoAction. And yeah, so our main, before the invasion, our main topic and our main focus was advocacy for ambitious climate and energy policy in Ukraine, Paris Agreement, CO2 emissions dropping down. So we have been truly engaged in that, plus in just energy transition, switching to renewables and energy efficiency. But when the invasion started, we stopped and tried to rethink what we can do in this condition. What topics that we were working on there still like we'll be able to do, and we decided on three main things. So first of all, we started to document Russian environmental crimes that are happening throughout Ukraine. So it's horrible, but we are used to seeing all this news about like what is happening, what happened in Bucha, what happened in Mariupol, what's currently happening in Bakhmut. But at the same time, there are also this story that is not being covered as much is about what is happening to Ukrainian environment in the southern Ukraine with the Black Sea, with the steppes, with everything. And we are using open data or using like public channels, news articles. We compiled and presented an online map. You can find it on our website with all the instances that we could find. And I think currently there are more than 900 instances. This is the first thing, and it actually really helped. It was one of the things our government tried to communicate, and we helped them. And at the same time, you can imagine, when the invasion started, I wasn't the only one who left Kyiv, and we had all like staff from EcoAction being in different countries and throughout Ukraine. And this was one of the things that kept us together, because it was one of the like actions that we could do together. We like message on Teams, and we have a separate workflow there, and we have been like there was a division, like one of our staff members were covering Odessa region, another was Kharkiv region, another one Kyiv region. So it also helped us internally to be able to stay as a team. So this is like environmental crimes. Another one is the advocacy that was very active last year about sanctions on Russian fossil fuels, on Russian oil, gas, and coal. Plus, we have been bringing the topic of Russian nuclear sector, which is still isn't sanctioned, but Rosatom, Russian nuclear company, still occupies the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. They're present there. There are no repercussions, which is very dangerous because it sets a crazy precedent that one country can invade another, seize a nuclear power plant, and nothing will happen. It cannot be like that. So we have been advocating for this kind of sanctions. And another one, which is currently our biggest one, is the green reconstruction of Ukraine. Yeah. So especially for the energy sector, we have different campaigns. One of them is focused on bringing Ukraine 100% renewable to renewables until 2050. Another one focused on energy efficiency in buildings, and two phase out campaigns, nuclear phase out and coal phase out. And we understood that all these topics, they can be brought under the umbrella of green construction. Mm-hmm. So reconstruction with renewables and with energy efficiency, reconstruction without coal and without nuclear and fossil fuels as a whole. So, and currently, that's one of the things I'll be advocating here in DC, is this concept of like United States can support Ukraine with renewables right now. It's about fast recovery of our energy system, and it can be done.
That's really interesting. I think, you know, environmental considerations are often low on the priority list when it comes to humanitarian response and post-conflict reconstruction. We've had a number of, that's been a focus of ECSP for a long time, and scholars like Ken Konka and others have done research on the sort of environmental attention cycle, right? And there's clear patterns of environmental issues falling off the radar over time, right? Because of the urgency of other issues. So I wonder, how are you balancing? I do think that in the context of Ukraine, there's been a shift, right? I think that we are seeing that there's more of a focus on the role that renewable energy can play in the long-term sort of energy security of the country. This need to shift from Soviet-built systems, right, to modern and green systems. But there's still this short-term urgency and need, right, especially with the country's sort of Russia's targeting of energy systems and water supplies and infrastructure. So how do you balance in your conversations and in your research the sort of short-term urgency of the issue with the long-term and sort of thinking now about what the structural changes are needed in the country to help sort of get to that more sustainable future?
We are trying to bring these topics together because one of the European Union countries and America helping Ukraine with emergency response to our energy system. And it means what it means, generators. These are generators that are working on fossil fuels. And we advocate for the greening of the emergency aid in the short term. So we are not particularly against diesel generators because we need them and we will need them next year. And like, okay, now is March, but November is not far ahead.
Right.
And we are saying, please diversify. Give us generators, but you can give us also solar panels. You can give us heat pumps. You can get us small wind power. So this is one of our focus, like this greening of the emergency aid. And I would say that the war is also fastened the conversation around renewables because we have, for years, you can imagine we are an environmental organization, and for years we have been advocating for a switch to decentralized generation with renewables on the community level. And it was always about like, oh, you can bring down pollution, it's more economically feasible, it's about climate change. But currently, you can imagine in Ukraine, climate change is not the first priority and not the first issue. So what now takes precedence is the question of energy security and resilience of communities. And that's what people currently understand more, and it's easier to communicate. So I don't want to paint also a rosy picture that like, oh, Ukrainian communities are ready for renewables. No. They're ready for anything and everything, including renewables. So our work now, it got a little bit easier because we have, Ukrainians currently have a strange and horrible collective experience of these targeted attacks on our energy infrastructure, on electricity cutoffs. And now people understand the value of having light. What does it mean for people? So they are more open to thinking about this decentralized generation. And even the term itself, decentralized generation, it got more mainstream. Our president, Zelensky, uses it, our prime minister of energy. And we also, from our side, we always try to highlight that, yes, decentralized generation, but based on renewables, not based on gas, not based, because there are also conversations that small modular nuclear reactors are also decentralized generation, which is, it isn't so. So we are focusing on this decentralized generation, and what our main message is that it doesn't make sense to plan this transition for after the war. we need to start doing the groundwork. So when the war ends, we have already like projects, ideas, concepts, strategies, and it can be implemented far quicker. So answering your question, long story short, we are trying to bring together this short-term perspective and long-term, and it's all based on renewables. So renewables can help now, and renewables will help in the future, because the decentralized system is much more harder to destroy, and we know that Ukraine will win. It's only a question of time, and we still assume that Russia will be our neighbor in some capacity, and what they will decide to do in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, 13 years' time, we don't know. So we need to be prepared also for that, for this kind of future.
What kind of coordination are you doing with sort of, you know, other NGOs working in this space, with civil society, with the sort of local, municipal, and the national government? Like, is there a strong coordination? Is it sort of a piecemeal, or how it works in particular cases?
I would maybe divide this question into three parts. The first part being the coordination between Ukrainian NGOs and civil society organizations. I would say it got much stronger because we understand that there is no like, we are not competing with one another, and we are trying to like do the same thing, and we're trying to pull all our resources, and we are currently coordinating with other NGOs on this emergency response with solar panels that we are getting from European Union. We are saying that we are ready to facilitate the dialogue with local communities, with national government, to actually spread it around, because we understand for our government it's also very hard to do everything at once, and we are extending our hand like with helping. And in that sense, I would say there was a big coordination between Ukrainian civil society organizations, environmental ones, but also on other topics, basically any topic you can think of. There is this kind of, we can do it together because we understand why we are doing it. Another, I would say, coordination is our government, national government. I would say our ministries got a little bit more open, especially with advocacy for sanctions and environmental crimes. So they are also asking us, and they're coming to us with some information, trying to build like bridges and create this kind of dialogue. We are also trying always with all our researches, all our activities, to come to our government and say, look, we are here and we can help. Okay, we did this research about renewables, like sociological survey that Ukrainians are ready for renewables. We shared it with our government. Our government uses it. So I think in that regard, it got a little bit more open. But at the same time, we understand that our government tries to do so much things at once in parallel, and they're moving very quickly. And when you're moving very quickly, there can be some stumbles, there can be some problems. And we are also trying to pinpoint them and also help like with our recommendations how to mitigate them. And another thing is cooperation with local municipalities. For eco-action, for years we have been, like for last 5 years, we have been working with coal towns in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine and western Ukraine, on the topic of just transition. So basically what to do when the coal mines will be shut down. And we have been cooperating with mayors, like with the local authorities, mayors, deputy mayors, directors of different departments, local NGOs. And currently they are very, very open to the idea that coal towns, Ukrainian coal towns, can be an example of the green reconstruction of Ukraine, because the situation there is very difficult. It was before the invasion, now more so, especially in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk region, because we have like towns that we have worked with. They are 20 minutes from Bakhmut. And one of the towns that we have been cooperating, Vuhledar, Russians are now trying to advance there. They're trying to capture Vuhledar. It's very difficult to speak to the people there. And so the local municipalities, they are very open, and we have other partners in Ukraine, other NGOs that are working on the municipal level. And one of the topics is that local authorities want to install solar panels on critical social infrastructure, in this case on hospitals. And there are already like 25 project ideas that are written and analyzed for 22 communities for installation of solar on hospitals. This is one of the one of the examples how this short-term help with renewables can actually benefit local communities. So local authorities currently, they are also very much engaged, open, and they understand that they cannot plan only by themselves, they need some help. Currently, we have plans, our government like mandates that Ukrainian communities have reconstruction plans. So they will be preparing them in 2023, and we are also trying to help the communities we are working with to bring this green aspect into it, this energy efficiency aspect, renewables aspect, and basically the environmental aspect.
How do you work with those sort of coal-focused communities in terms of like employment opportunities, right? When you're thinking about sort of the people who live there, as coal gets phased out, what does that mean for their own livelihoods?
Yeah, this is the question for these communities. And at first, so we started doing this work in 2018, and at first we were very apprehensive to bridging this topic with local authorities, because if you go into a coal community talking about phase out of coal, you can imagine it would be a very, very negative reaction. So our first event was focused about renewables and energy efficiency. Let's bring renewables, something like more positive. And when we sat down with coal town mayors from Eastern Ukraine, I was amazed that they were already talking about, like, they understood the problem in their communities with coal mines. That they know that it will be shut down in the future. It's a question of when, not if. And they were very open to ideas what to do. So we sat there and we're like, okay, we can help with that. And we engage them. And currently, one of our propositions for the employment is this idea of localization of development of renewable energy equipment in Ukraine, especially in carbon-intensive regions like coal regions. Because we understand that Ukraine will need renewables for our energy transition. We understand that the European Union is also dependent on Chinese solar panels and Chinese equipment. So why can't Ukraine produce and have this higher value, help Ukrainian energy transition, help European energy transition, and help coal communities that will be without like the main source of employment? And we are also, so it's a twofold question, because it would be very stupid, I would say, to replace one industry, coal industry, and replace it with another. Because it will create another dependency on one enterprise. So local authorities, they are very open to the idea of diversification of local economy, for the creation of like a big amount of different small and medium enterprises in their communities, and they are ready to do like the necessary changes in local law to be able to attract investment. But you can imagine that even before the start of the full scale invasion, it was difficult to work in Eastern Ukraine, now more so. And we are currently also engaged with coal towns in Western Ukraine that are near the Polish border, where it's safe-ish, and where like more projects like on the ground can be done than in Eastern Ukraine. Our reasoning is that we can try to do something in Western Ukraine in coal towns, and then use the experience for the reconstruction of the Eastern Ukrainian coal towns.
That's great. The work you're doing is so important, and in the context of the situation that you're working in, it's incredible what you've managed to achieve with your EcoAction team and the others working in this space. I wonder, as we sort of close out our conversation, my last question to you is how the international community can better support the work that you and your colleagues are doing.
I wouldn't be original here, because the war is still going on and Ukraine needs weapons, because I think all the attacks on our energy infrastructure can be like mitigated, the results, if we have the necessary weapons to defend ourselves. That's the first priority. Then I would say that international community can help Ukraine with renewable energy equipment right now. donations, maybe not donations, but maybe creating some local programs for municipalities to apply, for NGOs to apply, because the interest is there. Plus, you can help with your donations to Ukrainian environmental organizations. There is a special link on the UK Action website where you can help us, but also 9 other Ukrainian NGOs and the work that we are doing.
That's great. Thank you very much, Kostya, for taking the time to talk with us today. Thank you for the important work that you're doing. And I wish you safe travels home and a much better year ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.